and anointed many sick people with oil and healed them.
Several months ago, when Verna Miller asked me to preach, she suggested that this sermon be something of a testimony, an old-fashioned testimony. So I will be sharing some stories of our lives, Ken and my life, between brief scripture reflections on the two passages that were just read. And I will also name a few things we've learned from life and from scripture. But I give this testimony aware that I make decisions from a position of privilege. Father Greg Boyle, in his book, Preaching to the Choir, notes that not all choices are created equal. Mental illness, abuse, refugee status, and gang violence, and on, did not choose me, as they have chosen many. And so I speak with deep gratitude from the gift of life and the gift of choice that I have been given. The text from Joshua 24 calls the people to serve the God who brought them out of Egypt, serving in faithfulness and in sincerity. But if they're not willing to do that, then they will need to choose whom they will serve. And Joshua says at the end of his life, as he lays forth this call, that he and his house will be serving the Lord. Such a statement and such a choice sets the will, the spirit, and life in a certain direction, which affects then many other decisions that are made. Ken and I, as individuals and as a family, made that initial decision to say yes, to follow God with all our hearts and minds and souls. Now, our understanding of what that means has been tested and has changed over the years with many rich and wonderful life experiences. In the story from Mark 6, Jesus and his message and his mission are rejected by his own townspeople who came to the synagogue to hear him teach. Initially, they were astonished at his wisdom, but they soon began to speculate how this carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon, and of multiple unnamed sisters, could be teaching and doing such amazing things, and they took offense at him, so that he could not continue his work in his home community. Jesus moved on to other villages, and he also took steps to expand his ministry by sending out his followers with some specific instructions for how they are to move about in the work and the sending they are given. Jesus and his disciples continued to teach and to heal, and we know from other records that they made significant choices to leave their occupations, their homes, and even their families in their efforts to follow Jesus. As a part of today's testimony, I will share a few of the significant decisions that Ken and I have made over the years. The first one was to live and work in Somalia. Now, we had some external affirmation for that decision, including the potential call of the U.S. Draft Board during the Vietnam War, the invitation of a mission agency who sent us, and then the affirmation of many wonderful experiences through our subsequent 9 years of life in that country. But we also had times of internal questioning of these decisions to live and work in Somalia, and we experienced pain and struggle as we questioned. When we returned to Somalia in 1983 with our four children after being home in the United States for 10 years, we thought we knew as adults what we would be encountering, and we tried to prepare our children. Now, we did not go with only a staff and one change of clothing. Instead, we took 12 suitcases filled with what we thought we might need for 3 years. And although we told the children that we would be eating lots of bread and spaghetti, we did not prepare them for the flavor of the spaghetti. Nor did we have a clue what a stir and intensity of stares our family of six with our mixed race children would cause. Then, when a thief crawled over our wall and stole clothing off the line a few days after we had arrived, I severely injured my leg trying to chase after him. I went to bed and I cried and I cried and I cried. Even a get-to-know-you visit from several MCC people, bringing a box of rare cornflakes was hardly enough to get me out of bed. A few weeks later, we needed to move from that house because the landlord had doubled the rent. And through several weeks of hunting for another place, I resisted moving with all of my will. But with the help of friends, we finally found a house, not nearly as nice. Really, it wasn't, not just in my mind. And I still complained about the dust and the noise until we learned that the week after we moved, the cement ceiling of the bedroom that had been our daughter's had completely collapsed. Had we still been living there, and had they been in that room, they would have been killed or severely injured. A second major decision we made was to adopt three of our four children. Our oldest, who has often been told that he looks like Ken, a son with special physical and emotional needs, a daughter who came in the baby airlift from Vietnam, and then our birth daughter. Out of respect for them, I will not be telling stories about the joys and struggles that we experienced, stories that many of you could tell, whether your children are birth, adopted, or just part of your family. And although we might say, along with Joshua, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, that does not mean that children and grandchildren will always follow us. We do know that having children opens our hearts and our lives to great joy and also to the possibility of pain. We have experienced heartbreak and healing, racism towards our family members and generosity, hope and occasional despair. But we know that without our experiences with our children, we would not be who we are today. Sometimes more grace-filled towards people who make decisions that cause them harm and bring repercussions to those around them. We have also made many different decisions about our careers, and this leads me to tell young teens graduating from high school not to worry about what they're going to be doing for the rest of their lives, because it might change. Ken became a successful teacher and a mission administrator. And 20 years later, he became an IT person who probably did more conversions as businesses changed their computer programs than I ever helped people in changing their lives and life directions. Before retirement, he became a case manager facilitating peace and justice between people. I moved from being a registered nurse to an English teacher and a women's advocate, a psychiatric nurse, and then to becoming a pastor. Not always was the way very clear, but however and wherever we worked, we found ourselves deeply engaged in whatever's at hand. And then there was our decision to live in Lancaster. 14 years ago, when both of us were employed in this city, we decided to leave our home of 26 years in Mountjoy to move into and live in Lancaster. We had some concerns that our children, who had primary connections to that home other than our three-year sojourn in Africa, might not be happy with that decision. But as we consulted with them, our oldest said, "Mom and Dad, you've been talking about moving to Lancaster forever. Do it already." So although it may appear that making decisions is not difficult for us, obviously we have not made them all with ease. Oh, the places you'll go, right? Corners and directions that we don't always know. From the perspective of these and other life experiences, and from Jesus' example and teaching in Mark, I want to share a few of the lessons we have learned, and I have classified them for us under the headings of what we might need to let go of and what is good to hang on to as we are making decisions. We need to let go of the fear of rejection, of not being successful. Jesus gave some clear instructions what his disciples were to do if the message they were sharing was not well received. We did not exactly shake off our boots and go on to the next village, but in our work in Somalia, we needed to let go of the usual measures of missionary success. There was only a handful of people in the 9 years of our lives in Somalia who asked us to study the Bible or who chose to follow Jesus. There were many who knew us as people of the book, as people of integrity, as people who cared about their needs, personal needs, medical needs, educational needs. And as we lived and shared together, we developed a community of beloved people. Our views of the world, of Somalis, of Muslims, and their views of the world and of us made the kingdom of heaven visible and present, often beyond our expectations. We needed to let go of Lancaster Mennonite Conference's refusal to ordain women. Our story, Ken's and mine, and the story of other women and their supporting congregations would take longer than we have this morning to be told. Personal and congregational call was and continues to be too often rejected by men and women who interpret certain scriptures to defend their belief system and worldview. I often wanted to run away or attack back when that rejection came in the form of lengthy discernment processes and equivocation, or when a few individuals, sometimes women, wrote vitriolic letters defending the system. But being successful in the eyes of all is not the measure by which we make decisions. And we need to let go of the fear of not having enough. Jesus' instructions to his disciples about taking limited supplies is thought to not be particularly about asceticism, but much more about interdependence and developing a community that has a lot to offer. To demonstrate this, I will share another Somali story that shows our vulnerabilities and our struggles and the enough that was provided. In our third year of life in Somalia with our family, most of us became sick with dengue fever. There was no doctor that we knew of in town, but I diagnosed it by monitoring the symptoms and by reading the Merck manual, which was part of my Bible at that time. As some of us began recovering, Ken became quite restless and delirious with very high fevers. I struggled to sponge him down, to bring him that fever down to an acceptable level, and simultaneously gave permission for our oldest son to go fishing with the local Boy Scout troop off the pier that jutted into the Indian Ocean. After a few hours of fishing, I don't remember any fish coming back, the leaders brought him back without his glasses that had been lost when he and another boy were swept by a huge wave off the pier into the shark-infested ocean. The adults were able to rescue the boys, and he was safe. But I fell apart. Just at that time, several Somali friends stopped by with a gift of flour, which was a rare commodity at that particular time. They knew of a doctor in town, and they took me with them in their car to bring the doctor to the house. These men, these Muslim friends, comforted me. They brought us food and medical care and love. And we had enough. And finally, we must let go of our need of being independent, of doing it all alone. This is closely related to having enough. We find in the scriptures that Jesus sent his disciples out two by two, recognizing that being alone in life is very difficult. As we look back over our lives, we know that most of our major decisions involved consultation and prayer with others who cared about us and who were committed to helping us to find our way. These included friends and people who initially were strangers, but whom we learned to trust. It also included a congregation and church leaders who led the way for my eventual ordination against the approval of Lancaster Mennonite Conference. Let's look finally at what is important to hold on to. We have to hang on to humility, knowing that we will make mistakes, and I will not bore you with the many mistakes that we made as people and as parents as leaders and even as followers of Jesus Christ. Many times, we have needed to acknowledge these mistakes and choose to make different choices and adapt different attitudes and behaviors. A Somali friend, a poet, singer, and father whose son I had helped, this man came to say goodbye to us when we were leaving the country for the last time in 1986. And among other comments, he said, "Libby," that's what I was called, "Libby, we know you. Your tongue is often quick, but your heart is big." As I said, humility is essential, even in accepting farewells and compliments. God's love and real care is real, even in the most difficult circumstances. And although we may have trouble remembering that God's love, presence, and provision are still with us when things are hard, it is a reality that we can trust, or others may need to hold out to us when things seem to be falling apart. Sometimes we have special God experiences that help us to hold on to this truth of God with us. I had such a God encounter that I have returned to many, many times since then. This experience took place toward the end of our sixth year in Somalia. Ken and I had been through some difficult personal matters, and we were on a healing journey. The mission school had been nationalized by the Somali government, and there were many uncertainties about the mission educational programs. Our family of three, a three-year-old son, was planning to return to the United States in a few months with no clarity about what we would be doing or where we would be living. We had gone to the capital, Mogadishu, for a few days of shopping. And in the middle of the night, Ken woke me up as he tossed in bed with severe pain. We woke the missionary family with whom we were staying to ask about possible medical help, or at least for some Tylenol. We didn't even have that with us. The pain medication was not effective, and no one knew of any medical help in the city. Ken was rolling on the floor with excruciating pain. Finally, one of us missionaries said, "Maybe we should pray." And so we did, with tears and with hesitation. And in the middle of our halting prayers, Ken sat up and said he felt better. We did not believe him. But eventually everyone went back to bed, and Ken slept like a baby. I lay in bed, half sleeping and experiencing a visitation of God coming to me, asking if I would trust for our marriage, for our children, for our move back home, and on and on. And each time I agreed that yes, I will trust, another area of questioning came up. It was a light-filled, holy moment, full of God's grace and presence that I still cherish. The next morning, I tried to share with others that deep sense of God's glory and the awareness of God with us that had been given to me, while Ken eventually passed his first kidney stone. Finally, we can hold on to an expanded understanding and awareness that life and this world are much bigger than we are and that we can even imagine. This vision of life beyond our own experiences grows as we allow ourselves to be grounded in the community of God's people around the world, people of different faiths, different values, different worldviews. And as we grow in communion with the earth and our appreciation of all that sustains life and being. Sometimes Ken and I, perhaps like some of you, reflect on Robert Frost's poem recited earlier by Chris, and we wonder aloud how our lives might be different if we had traveled a different road, if we had never gone to Somalia, if we had never adopted children, if we had chosen other career paths. We have occasionally looked back, but we cannot go back. And we have acknowledged that our choices have made all the difference in who we are and where we are. Each of us have choices to make, some big, others smaller, even daily. And each of you here could give testimony of decisions worth making, of needing to be made as you have lived your lives. Maybe we should spend a year hearing those testimonies. We know, too, that we need to keep on making choices that reinforce previous ones that we have made. Again, quoting Father Gregory Boyle, choosing for life, in a vocation, a marriage, or recovery has to be ongoing. He says a yes needs to be repeated, deepened, made new over and over again, or else it ultimately becomes a no. May each of us find our way to ongoing yeses for life and for hope, aware of God's grace and presence within us and among us. Thanks be to God.
Good morning.